and Portugal, as his father's minister to Prussia and as Madison's minister to Russia. He spoke 14 languages. As Secretary of State, he drafted the Monroe Doctrine, establishing the principle that the United States would keep out of wars in Europe, but would consider any European colonial ventures in the Americas as acts of aggression. By the time he decided to seek the presidency, he'd also served as a U.S. senator and as a professor of logic at Brown and professor of rhetoric and oratory at Harvard. In 1824, it was said that American voters faced a choice between John Quincy Adams, who can write, and Andrew Jackson, who can fight. If the battle between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson had determined whether aristocracy or republicanism would prevail, and with Jefferson, republicanism won, the battle between Andrew Jackson and John Quincy Adams would determine whether republicanism or democracy would prevail, and with Jackson, democracy would eventually win. Jackson's rise to power marked the birth of American populism. The argument of populism is that the best government is that most closely directed by a popular majority. Populism is an argument about the people, but at heart, it is an argument about numbers. A national hero after the Battle of New Orleans, Jackson had gone on to lead campaigns against the Seminoles, the Chickasaws, and the Choctaws, pursuing a mixed strategy of treaty-making and war-making, with far more of the latter than the former, as part of a plan to remove all Indians living in the southeastern United States to lands to the west. He was provincial and poorly educated. Later, when Harvard gave Jackson an honorary doctorate, John Quincy Adams refused to attend the ceremony, calling him a barbarian who could not write a sentence of grammar and can hardly spell his own name. He had a well-earned reputation for being ferocious, ill-humored, and murderous, on the battlefield and off. When he ran for president, he had served less than a year in the Senate. Of his bid for the White House, Jefferson declared, "He is one of the most unfit men I know of for such a place." Jackson made a devilishly shrewd decision. He would make his lack of certain qualities, judiciousness, education, political experience, into strengths. He would run as a hot-tempered military man who'd pulled himself up by his own bootstraps. To do this, he needed to tell the story of his life. Within weeks of his victory at the Battle of New Orleans, in preparation for a political career, he hired a biographer, 65-year-old David Ramsey, a South Carolina legislator and physician and gifted historian, whose books included a 2-volume History of the American Revolution, 1789, and a heroic Life of George Washington, 1807. But before Ramsey could begin work on the biography, he was shot in the back on the streets of Charleston. Jackson hired his aide-de-camp John Reed, who drafted 4 chapters, before he too died an unfortunate and unexpected death. "The book must be finished," Jackson insisted. He turned next to a 26-year-old lawyer named John Eaton, who had served under Jackson during the Creek War and the War of 1812. Eaton was Jackson's bosom friend and adopted son, according to Margaret Bayard Smith, a novelist and remarkably astute observer of Washington society and politics. Her husband, Samuel Harrison Smith, was the president of the Bank of the United States. Eaton's Life of Andrew Jackson appeared in 1817. The next year, Eaton was elected to the Senate, and in 1823, when Jackson joined him in Washington, the two senators from Tennessee shared lodgings. Andrew Jackson, man of the people, was the first presidential candidate to campaign for the office, the first to appear on campaign buttons, and nearly the first to publish a campaign biography. In 1824, when Jackson announced his bid for the presidency, Eaton, who ran Jackson's campaign, shrewdly revised his Life of Andrew Jackson, deleting or dismissing everything in Jackson's past that looked bad, and lavishing attention on everything that looked good, and turning into strengths what earlier had been considered weaknesses. Eaton's Jackson wasn't uneducated, he was self-taught. He wasn't ill-bred, he was self-made. The election of 1824 also altered the very method of electing a president. Why should a party's nominee be selected by a caucus in Congress? The legislative caucus worked only so long as voters didn't mind that they had virtually no role in electing the president. Calls for the beheading of King Caucus had begun in 1822, when the New York American asked, "Why should not a general convention of Republican delegates from the different states assemble at Washington a few months prior to the period for electing a president and decide by a majority the choice of an individual for that elevated office?" 2 years later, popular opposition to the caucus had grown. After word got out to the press about a caucus meeting to be held in the House, only 6 out of 240 legislators were willing to appear before a disgruntled public, which flooded the gallery shouting, "Adjourn! Adjourn!" And so it did. With the caucus dead, John Quincy Adams, John C. Calhoun, and Henry Clay simply declared their candidacies. Jackson looked for a popular mandate. He was nominated by the Tennessee legislature. The momentum behind Jackson's candidacy drew as well on the power of newly enfranchised voters. When new states entered the Union, they held conventions to draft and ratify their own state constitutions. They almost always adopted more democratic arrangements than those that prevailed in the 13 original states. They abolished property requirements for voting, replaced judicial appointment with judicial elections, and provided for the popular election of delegates to the Electoral College. The new and more democratic state constitutions put pressure on older states to revise their own constitutions. By 1821, property qualifications for voting no longer existed in 21 out of 24 states. 3 years later, 18 out of the 24 states held popular elections for delegates to the Electoral College. More and poorer white men came to the polls and were elected to office, much to the dismay of conservatives like Chancellor James Kent of New York, who at New York's 1821 Constitutional Convention complained, "The notion that every man that works a day in the road or serves an idle hour in the militia is entitled as a right to an equal participation in the whole power of government is most unreasonable and has no foundation in justice." He believed in proportionate representation, representation proportionate to wealth. "Society is an association for the protection of property, as well as of life, and the individual who contributes only 1 cent to the common stock ought not to have the same power and influence in directing the property concerns of the partnership as he who contributes his thousands." As the kind of people who could vote changed, so did the method of voting. Early paper voting had been unwieldy and inconvenient. Voters were expected to bring to the polls a scrap of paper on which they could write the names of their chosen candidates. With the electorate expanding, this system became even more impractical. Party leaders began to print ballots, usually in partisan newspapers, usually in long strips, listing an entire slate as a party ticket. The ticket system consolidated the power of the parties and contributed to the expansion of the electorate. Party tickets meant that voters didn't need to know how to write or even how to read. Each party ticket was printed on a different color paper, and each was stamped with a party symbol. In 1824, Jackson won both the popular vote and a plurality, though not a majority, of the electoral vote. The election was thrown into the House, which chose John Quincy Adams after Henry Clay threw his support behind him. Adams then appointed Clay his Secretary of State. Jefferson wrote to John Adams to congratulate him on his son's election. Having retired from politics, the two men had renewed the friendship of their youth. "Every line from you exhilarates my spirits," Adams replied. Jackson, furious at what he deemed a corrupt bargain, resigned from the Senate in 1825, returned to the Hermitage, and bided his time while the electorate swelled. Between 1824 and 1828, it more than doubled, growing from 400,000 to 1.1 million. Men who had attended the Constitutional Convention in 1787 shook their gray-haired heads and warned that Americans had crowned a new monarch, King Numbers. On July 4th, 1826, the United States celebrated its Jubilee, the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. In cities and towns, Americans paraded and sang and raised glasses and listened to speeches. Many of those speeches celebrated the new spirit of democracy, the defeat of the contempt for the people that had been part of the nation's founding. There may be those who scoff at the suggestion that the decision of the whole is to be preferred to the judgment of the enlightened few, said the historian George Bancroft, speaking in Boston. They say in their hearts that the masses are ignorant, that farmers know nothing of legislation, that mechanics should not quit their workshops to join in forming public opinion. But true political science does indeed venerate the masses. The voice of the people, Bancroft insisted, is the voice of God. Nothing more clearly marked the end of the founding era than the coincidence of the deaths of two men on that very day. Thomas Jefferson, the pen of the Declaration, and John Adams, the voice of independence. Adams, 90, died at his home in Massachusetts. "He breathed his last about 6 o'clock in the afternoon," reported one newspaper, "while millions of his fellow countrymen were engaged in festive rejoicings at the nation's jubilee and in chanting praises to the immortal patriots whose valor and virtue accomplished their country's freedom and independence." He had been declining for years. He'd lost his teeth and his eyesight. He slept in an overstuffed armchair in his library, in a dressing coat and a cotton cap, surrounded by his books. He left them, in his will, to his son John Quincy. Cannons fired on the 4th were nearly drowned out by the sound of thunder, an afternoon storm. Having been carried to his bed, Adams stirred and whispered, "Thomas Jefferson survives." At 6:20, he died. But in Virginia, Jefferson, 83, had died at 10 minutes before 1. In a will that Jefferson had made months before, he'd freed the last two of his children with Sally Hemings, Madison and Esten. He did not mention Sally. Invited to celebrate the 4th of July in Washington, Jefferson had instead sent a letter of regret and words upon the day, celebrating this self-evident truth. "The mass of mankind has not been born with saddles on their backs, nor a favored few booted and spurred ready to ride them." He was dying, suffering and in pain. He'd been dosed with laudanum. He'd slept through most of July 2nd and July 3rd, and then refused the medicine. He died on the 4th, while the bells in nearby Charlottesville tolled the anniversary of American independence. Sally Hemings's brother John built Jefferson's coffin. 6 months later, to pay his debts, Jefferson's entire estate, including 130 slaves, was sold at an auction. The Fawcett children, cousins of Sally Hemings's, were among the 130 valuable Negroes sold to the highest bidder. Hemings, 53 years old, was appraised at $50, but she was not sold at auction. She had by then quietly left Monticello for Charlottesville, where she lived until her death. From Monticello, she brought with her a pair of Jefferson's eyeglasses to remember him by, a man of sight and of blindness. Their daughter, Harriet Hemings, was 27 and still living in Washington in 1828 when Andrew Jackson finally defeated John Quincy Adams in an election that marked the founding of the Democratic Party. Jackson's party, the party of the common man, the farmer, the artisan, the people's party. Jackson won a whopping 56% of the popular vote, 4 times as many white men cast a ballot in 1828 as in 1824. They voted in throngs. They voted by casting ballots, not balls, but slips of paper, Jackson tickets, with which they cast their votes for Jackson delegates to the Electoral College and for an entire slate of Democratic Party candidates. The majority ruled. Watching the rise of American democracy, an aging political elite despaired and feared that the Republic could not survive the rule of the people, wrote John Randolph of Virginia, "The country is ruined past redemption." On a mild winter's day, March 4th, 1829, 20,000 Americans turned up in Washington for Andrew Jackson's unruly inauguration. Steamboats from Alexandria offered discounted passage across the Potomac. "Thousands and thousands of people without distinction of rank collected in an immense mass around the Capitol," wrote Margaret Bayard Smith. Jackson was the first president to deliver his inaugural address to the American people. Following the practice established by Jefferson, he walked to the Capitol instead of riding. Harriet Hemings might have watched from a sidewalk. John Marshall administered the oath of office. Margaret Bayard Smith said that when Jackson began to speak, an almost breathless silence succeeded, and the multitude was still, listening to catch the sound of his voice. His voice rising, he celebrated the triumph of numbers. "The first principle of our system," Jackson said, "is that the majority is to govern." He bowed to the people. Then, all at once, the people nearly crushed him with their affection. It was only with difficulty that he made his way through the Capitol and down the hill to the gateway that opens on the avenue, Smith reported. Supreme Court Justice Joseph Story attended the swearing-in and then left, bemoaning the reign of King Mob. Even after the president mounted a horse, the people followed him. "Countrymen, farmers, gentlemen, mounted and dismounted. Boys, women, and children, black and white," Smith wrote. "Carriages, wagons, and carts all pursuing him to the president's house." They followed Jackson from the steps of the Capitol all the way to the White House, where, for the first time, the doors were opened to the public. "A rabble, a mob of boys, Negroes, women, children, scrambling, fighting, romping," wrote Smith. "Ladies fainted, men were seen with bloody noses, and such a scene of confusion took place as it is impossible to describe. Those who got in could not get out by the door again, but had to scramble out of windows." There was a real worry that the people might press the president to death before the day came to an end. "But it was the people's day," she wrote, "and the people's president, and the people would rule." The rule of numbers had begun. Chapter 6. The Soul and the Machine. Maria W. Stewart, dark and beautiful, carried a manuscript tucked under her arm as she picked her way through the cobbled streets of Boston to the offices of the Liberator at 11 Merchants Hall, down by the docks. "Our souls are fired with the same love of liberty and independence with which your souls are fired," she'd written in an essay she hoped to publish. The descendant of slaves, she'd been born free in Connecticut in 1803. Orphaned at 5, she'd been bound as a servant to a clergyman till she turned 15. In August of 1826, weeks after the 50th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence and the deaths of John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, she'd married a much older man. She was 23, her husband, James W. Stewart, described as a tolerably stout and well-built man, a light, bright mulatto, had served as a sailor during the War of 1812. Captured, he'd been a prisoner of war. "It is the blood of our fathers and the tears of our brethren that have enriched your soils," Maria Stewart wrote in her first revolutionary essay about American history, "and we claim our rights." William Lloyd Garrison, the editor of The Liberator, was 2 years younger than Stewart. He'd apprenticed as a typesetter and worked as a printer and an editor and failed again and again before founding his most radical newspaper. A thin, balding white man, he slept on a bed on the floor of his cramped office, a printing press in the corner. He kept a cat to catch rats. Stewart told Garrison she wished to write for his newspaper, to say what she thought needed saying to the American people. Impressed with her intelligence and excellence of character, he later recalled, he published the first of her essays in 1831 in a column called The Ladies' Department. "This is the land of freedom," Stewart wrote. "Every man has a right to express his opinion. And every woman, too." She asked, "How long shall the fair daughters of Africa be compelled to bury their minds and talents beneath a load of iron pots and kettles?" Stewart was a born-again Christian, caught up in a religious revival that swept the country and reached its height in the 1820s and 1830s, in the factory towns that grew like kudzu along a path cut by the Erie Canal from the Hudson River to the Great Lakes, where the power of steam and the anxiety of industrialization were answered by the power of Christ and the assurance of the gospel. Before the revival began, a scant 1 in 10 Americans were church members. By the time it ended, that ratio had risen to 8 in 10. The Presbyterian minister Lyman Beecher called it the greatest work of God and the greatest revival of religion that the world has ever seen. The revival, known as the Second Great Awakening, infused American politics with the zealotry of millennialism. Its most ardent converts believed that they were on the verge of eliminating sin from the world, which would make possible the second coming of Christ, who was expected to arrive in as short a time as 3 months, and to come not to the Holy Lands, to Bethlehem or Jerusalem, but to the industrializing United States, to Cincinnati and Chicago, to Detroit and to Utica. Its ministers preached the power of the people, offering a kind of spiritual Jacksonianism. "God has made man a free moral agent," said the thundering 6'3" firebrand Charles Grandison Finney. And the revival was revolutionary. By emphasizing spiritual equality, it strengthened protests against slavery and against the political inequality of women. "It is not the color of the skin that makes the man or the woman," wrote Stewart, "but the principles formed in the soul." The democratization of American politics was hastened by revivalists like Stewart, who believed in the salvation of the individual through good works and in the equality of all people in the eyes of God. Against that belief stood the stark and brutal realities of an industrializing age, the grinding of souls. 1. The United States was born as a republic and grew into a democracy, and as it did, it split in two, unable to reconcile its system of government with the institution of slavery. In the first decades of the 19th century, democracy came to be celebrated, the right of a majority to govern became dogmatic, and the right to vote was extended to all white men, developments much derided by conservatives who warned that the rule of numbers would destroy the republic. By the 1830s, the American experiment had produced the first large-scale popular democracy in the history of the world, a politics expressed in campaigns and parades, rallies and conventions, with a two-party system run by partisan newspapers, and by an electorate educated in a new system of publicly funded schools. The great debates of the middle decades of the 19th century had to do with the soul and the machine. One debate merged religion and politics. What were the political consequences of the idea of equality of souls? Could the soul of America be redeemed from the nation's original sin, the Constitution's sanctioning of slavery? Another debate merged politics and technology. Could the nation's new democratic traditions survive in the age of the factory, the railroad, and the telegraph? If all events in time can be explained by earlier events in time, if history is a line and not a circle, then the course of events, change over time, is governed by a set of laws, like the laws of physics, and driven by a force, like gravity. What is that force? Is change driven by God, by people, or by machines? Is progress the progress of Pilgrim's Progress, John Bunyan's 1678 allegory, the journey of a Christian from sin to salvation? Is progress the extension of suffrage, the spread of democracy? Or is progress invention, the invention of new machines? A distinctively American idea of progress involved geography as destiny, picturing improvement as change not only over time, but over space. In 1824, Jefferson wrote that a traveler crossing the continent from east to west would be conducting a survey in time of the progress of man from the infancy of creation to the present day, since in his progress he would meet the gradual shades of improving man. His traveler, a surveyor at once of time and space, would begin with the savages of the Rocky Mountains, these he would observe in the earliest stage of association, living under no law but that of nature, subscribing and covering themselves with the flesh and skins of wild beasts. Moving eastward, Jefferson's imaginary traveler would then stop on our frontiers, where he'd find savages in the pastoral state raising domestic animals to supply the defects of hunting. Next, farther east, he'd meet our own semi-barbarous citizens, the pioneers of the advance of civilization. Finally, he'd reach the seaport towns of the Atlantic, finding man in his as-yet most improved state. Maria Stuart's Christianity stipulated the spiritual equality of all souls, but Jefferson's notion of progress was hierarchical. That hierarchy in Jackson's era was the logic behind African colonization, and was also the logic behind a federal government policy known as Indian removal. Native peoples living east of the Mississippi were required to settle in lands to the west. A picture of progress as the stages from barbarism to civilization, stages that could be traced on a map of the American continent, competed with a picture of progress as an unending chain of machines. The age of the machine had begun in 1769 in Glasgow, when James Watt patented an improvement on the steam engine. People had tapped into natural sources of power for manufacturing before, with water wheels and windmills, but Watts's model produced 5 times the power of a water wheel and didn't need to be sited on a river. A steam engine could work anywhere. Watt reckoned the power of a horse at 10 times the power of a man. He defined 1 horsepower as the energy required to lift 550 pounds by 1 foot in 1 second. Powered by steam, manufacturing became, in the 19th century, 200 times more efficient than it had been in the 18th century. That this invention would eventually upend political arrangements is prefigured in a likely apocryphal story told at the time about Watt and the King of England. When King George III went to a factory to see Watt's engine at work, he was told that the factory was manufacturing an article of which kings were fond. "What is that article?" he asked. The reply, "Power." There followed machine upon machine, steam-driven looms, steam-driven boats, making for faster production, faster travel, and cheaper goods. Steam-powered industrial production altered the economy, and it also altered social relations, especially between men and women and between the rich and the poor. The anxiety and social dislocation produced by those changes fueled the revival of religion. Everywhere, the flame of revival burned brightest in factory towns. Before the rise of the factory, home and work weren't separate places. Most people lived on farms where both men and women worked in the fields. In the winter, women spent most of their time carding, spinning, and weaving wool sheared from sheep. In towns and cities, shopkeepers and masters of artisanal trades, bakers, tailors, printers, shoemakers, lived in their shops, where they usually made their goods. They also shared this living space with journeymen and apprentices. Artisans made things whole, undertaking each step in the process of manufacturing. A baker baked a loaf, a tailor stitched a suit. With the rise of the factory came the division of labor into steps, done by different workers. With steam power, not only were the steps in the manufacturing process divided, but much of the labor was done by machines, which came to be known as mechanical slaves. New, steam-powered machines could also spin and weave, and even weave in ornate, multicolored patterns. In 1802, Joseph-Marie Jacquard, a French weaver, invented an automated loom. By feeding into his loom stiff paper cards with holes punched in them, he could instruct it to weave in any pattern he liked. 2 decades later, the English mathematician Charles Babbage used Jacquard's method to devise a machine that could compute. That is, it could make mathematical calculations. He called it the difference engine, a giant mechanical hand-cranked calculating machine that could tabulate any polynomial function. Then he invented another machine, he called it the analytical engine, that could apply the act of mechanical tabulation to solve any problem that involved logic. Babbage never built a working machine, but Ada Lovelace, a mathematician and the daughter of Lord Byron, later prepared a detailed description and analysis of the principles and promises of Babbage's work, the first account of what would become, in the 20th century, a general-purpose computer. In the United States, with its democracy of numbers, a calculating computer, a machine that could count, would one day throw a wrench in the machinery of government. But long before that day came, Americans devised simpler machines. Watt jealously guarded his patents. In 1810, an American merchant named Francis Cabot Lowell toured England's textile mills and made sketches from memory. In New England, working from those sketches, he designed his own machines and began raising money to build his own factory. Lowell died in 1817. His successors opened the Lowell Mills on the Merrimack River in 1823. Every step from carding to cloth was done in the same set of factories, 6 brick buildings erected around a central clock tower. Inspired by the social reformer Robert Owen, Lowell had meant his system as a model, an alternative to the harsh conditions found in factories in England. He called it a philanthropic manufacturing college. The Lowell mill owners hired young women, transplants from New England farms. They worked 12 hours a day and attended lectures in the evening. They published a monthly magazine. But the utopia that Francis Cabot Lowell imagined didn't last. By the 1830s, mill owners had cut wages and sped up the pace of work, and when women protested, they were replaced by men. Factories accelerated production. Canals accelerated transportation. The Erie Canal, completed in 1825, took 8 years to dig and covered 360 miles. Before the canal, the wagon trip from Buffalo to New York City took 20 days. On the canal, it took 6. The price of goods plummeted. The standard of living soared. A mattress that cost $50 in 1815, which meant that almost no one owned one, cost only $5 in 1848. One stop on the Erie Canal was Rochester, a mill town on the shore of Lake Ontario that processed the grain from surrounding farms. In 1818, Rochester exported 26,000 barrels of flour a year. Its mills were small, made up of 12 to 15 men working alongside a master in a single room in the master's house. There was, as there had been in such shops for centuries, a great deal of drinking. Workers were often paid not in wages but in liquor. Work wasn't done by the clock, but by the task. By the end of the 1820s, after the completion of the canal, these small shops had become bigger shops, typically divided into 2 rooms and employing many more men, each doing a smaller portion of the work, and generally working by the clock for wages. Work came to mean not simply labor, but a place, the factory or the banker's or the clerk's office, a place men went every day for 10 to 12 hours. Home was where women remained, and where what they did all day was no longer considered work. That is, they were not paid. The lives of women and men diverged. Wage workers became less and less skilled. Owners made more and more money. Rochester was exporting 200,000 barrels of flour a year by 1828, and by the end of the 1830s, 500,000. In 1829, a newspaper editor who used the word boss had to define it, a foreman or master workman of modern coinage. By the early 1830s, only the boss still worked in the shop. His employees worked in factories. Masters or bosses no longer lived in shops or even in the neighborhoods of factories. They moved to new neighborhoods, enclaves of a new middle class. That new middle class soon grew concerned about the unruliness of workers and especially about their drinking. Inspired by a temperance crusade led by the revivalist Lyman Beecher, a group of mill owners formed the Rochester Society for the Promotion of Temperance. Its members pledged to give up all liquor and to stop paying their workers in alcohol. Swept up in the spirit of evangelical revival, they began to insist that their workers join their churches, and they ultimately fired those who did not. In this effort, they were led principally by their wives. Women led the temperance movement, spurred to this particular crusade, not least because drunken husbands tended to beat their wives. Few laws protected women from such assaults. Husbands addicted to drinking also spent their wages on liquor, leaving their children hungry. Since married women had no right to own property, they had no recourse under the law. Convincing men to give up alcohol seemed the best solution. But the movement was also a consequence of deeper and broader changes. With the separation of home from work, there emerged an ideology of separate spheres. The public world of work and politics was the world of men. The private world of home and family was the world of women. Women, within this understanding, were the gentler sex, more nurturing, more loving, more moral. One advice manual, A Voice to the Married, told wives that they should make the home a haven for their husbands, an Elysium to which he can flee and find rest from the story strife of a selfish world. These changes in the family had begun before industrialization, but industrialization sped them up. Middle-class and wealthier women began having fewer children, an average of 3.6 children per woman in the 1830s, compared to 5.8 a generation earlier. No new method of contraception made this possible. Declining fertility was the consequence of abstinence. Lyman Beecher wielded enormous influence in this era of reform, and so did his indomitable daughter, Catherine, who advocated for the education of girls and published a treatise on domestic economy, advice for housewives. But the most powerful preacher to this new middle class, and especially to its women, was Charles Grandison Finney. Finney had been born again in 1821 when he was 29, and the Holy Spirit descended upon him, as he put it, like a wave of electricity. He was ordained 3 years later by a female missionary society. He held big meetings and small tent meetings and prayer groups. He looked his listeners in the eye. "A revival is not a miracle," he said. "We are either marching towards heaven or towards hell. How is it with you?" Women didn't always constitute the majority of converts, but their influence was felt on many who did convert. Another female missionary society invited Finney to Rochester in 1830, where he preached every night and three times on Sunday for 6 months. He preached to all classes, all sexes, and all ages, but above all, to women. Church membership doubled during Finney's 6 month stay in Rochester, driven by women. The vast majority of new joiners, more than 70%, followed the faith of their mothers, but not of their fathers. One man complained after Finney visited, "He stuffed my wife with tracts and alarmed her fears, and nothing short of meetings day and night could atone for the manifold sins my poor simple spouse had committed, and at the same time she made the miraculous discovery that she had been unevenly yoked." By exercising their power as moral reformers, the wives and daughters of factory owners brought their men into churches. Factory owners began posting job signs that read, "None but temperate men need apply." They even paid their workers to go to church. The revival was, for many Americans, heartfelt and abiding, but for others, it was not. As one Rochester mill worker said, "I don't give a damn. I get $5 more a month than before I got religion." If the sincerity of converts was often dubious, another kind of faith was taking deeper root in the 1820s, an evangelical faith in technological progress, an unquestioning conviction that each new machine was making the world better. That faith had a special place in the United States, as if machines had a distinctive destiny on the American continent. In prints and paintings, progress appeared as a steam-powered locomotive chugging across the continent, unstoppable. Writers celebrated inventors as men of progress and conquerors of nature, and lauded their machines as far worthier than poetry. The triumph of the sciences over the arts meant the defeat of the ancients by the moderns. The genius of Eli Whitney, hero of modernity, was said to rival that of Shakespeare. The head of the U.S. Patent Office declared the steamboat a mightier epic than the Iliad. In 1829, Jacob Bigelow, the Rumford Professor of Physical and Mathematical Sciences at Harvard, delivered a series of lectures called The Elements of Technology. Before Bigelow, technology had meant the arts, mostly the mechanical arts. Bigelow used the word to mean the application of science for the benefit of society. For him, the march of improvement amounted to a kind of mechanical millennialism. Next to the influence of Christianity in our moral nature, he later proclaimed, technology has had a leading sway in promoting the progress and happiness of our race. His critics charged him with preaching the gospel of machinery. The Welshman Thomas Carlyle, calling the era the Age of Machinery, complained that faith in machines had grown into a religious delusion, as wrong and as dangerous as a belief in witchcraft. Carlyle argued that people like Bigelow, who believed that machines liberate mankind, made a grave error. Machines are prisons. Free in hand and foot, we are shackled in heart and soul with far straighter than feudal chains, Carlyle insisted, fettered by chains of our own forging. American writers, refuting Carlyle, argued that the age of machinery was itself making possible the rise of democracy. In 1831, an Ohio lawyer named Timothy Walker, replying to Carlyle, claimed that by liberating the ordinary man from the drudgery that would otherwise prohibit his full political participation, machines drive democracy. Opponents of Andrew Jackson had considered his presidency not progress, but decay. The republic has degenerated into a democracy, one Richmond newspaper declared in 1834. To Jackson's supporters, his election marked not degeneration, but a new stage in the history of progress. Nowhere was this argument made more forcefully, or more influentially, than in George Bancroft's History of the United States from the Discovery of the American Continent to the Present. The book itself, reviewers noted, voted for Jackson. The spread of evangelical Christianity, the invention of new machines, and the rise of American democracy convinced Bancroft that humanism is steady advancing and that the advance of liberty and justice is certain. That advance, men like Bancroft and Jackson believed, required Americans to march across the continent to carry these improvements from east to west, the way Jefferson had pictured it. Democracy, John O'Sullivan, a New York lawyer and Democratic editor, argued in 1839, is nothing more or less than Christianity in its earthly aspect. O'Sullivan would later coin the term manifest destiny to describe this set of beliefs, the idea that the people of the United States were fated to overspread and to possess the whole of the continent which Providence has given for the development of the great experiment of liberty. To evangelical Democrats, democracy, Christianity, and technology were levers of the same machine. And yet all along there were critics and dissenters and objectors who saw in the soul of the people, in the march of progress, in the unending chain of machines, in the seeming forward movement of history, little but violence and backwardness and a great crushing of men, women, and children. Oh, America, America, Maria Stuart cried, foul and indelible is thy stain. Stuart had studied the Bible from childhood, a study she kept up her whole life, even as she scrubbed other people's houses and washed other people's clothes. While my hands are toiling for their daily sustenance, she wrote, my heart is most generally meditating upon its divine truths. She considered slavery a sin. She took inspiration from Scripture. I have borrowed much of my language from the Holy Bible, she said. But she also borrowed much of her language, especially the language of rights, from the Declaration of Independence. That the revival of Christianity coincided with the 50th anniversary of the Declaration, an anniversary made all the more mystical when the news spread that both Jefferson and Adams had died on that very day, July 4, 1826, as if by the hand of God, meant that the Declaration itself took on a religious cast. The self-evident secular truths of the Declaration of Independence became, to evangelical Americans, the truths of revealed religion. To say that this marked a turn away from the spirit of the nation's founding is to wildly understate the case. The United States was founded during the most secular era in American history, either before or since. In the late 18th century, church membership was low and anti-clerical feeling was high. It is no accident that the Constitution does not mention God. Philadelphia physician Benjamin Rush wondered, politely, whether this error might be corrected, assuming it to have been an oversight. Perhaps an acknowledgement might be made of his goodness or of his providence in the proposed amendments, he urged. No correction was made. The United States was not founded as a Christian nation. The Constitution prohibits religious tests for office holders. The Bill of Rights forbids the federal government from establishing a religion. James Madison, having argued that to establish a religion would be to foster in those who still reject it a suspicion that its friends are too conscious of its fallacies to trust it to its own merits. These were neither casual omissions nor accidents. They represented an intentional disavowal of a constitutional relationship between church and state, a disavowal that was not infrequently specifically stated. In 1797, John Adams signed the Treaty of Tripoli, securing the release of American captives in North Africa, and promising that the United States would not engage in a holy war with Islam, because the government of the United States of America is not in any sense founded on the Christian religion. But during the Second Great Awakening, evangelicals recast the nation's origins as avowedly Christian. "Upon what was America founded?" Maria Stuart asked and answered. "Upon religion and pure principles." Lyman Beecher argued that the Republic in its constitution and laws is of heavenly origin. Nearly everything took on a religious cast during the revival, not least because of the proliferation of preachers. In 1775, there had been 1,800 ministers in the United States. By 1845, there were more than 40,000. There were Baptist, Methodist, Presbyterian, Congregationalist, Episcopalian, Universalist, and more. Very much the flowering of religious expression that Madison had predicted would result from the prohibition of an established religion. The separation of church and state allowed religion to thrive. That was one of its intentions. Lacking an established state religion, Americans founded new sects, from Shakers to Mormons, and rival Protestant denominations sprung up in town after town. Increasingly, the only unifying national religion was a civil religion, a belief in the American creed. This faith bound the nation together and provided extraordinary political stability in an era of astonishing change. But it also tied it to the past in ways that often proved crippling. In 1816, when Jefferson was 73 and the awakening was just beginning, he warned against worshiping the men of his generation. "This they would say themselves were they to rise from the dead," he wrote. "Laws and institutions must go hand in hand with the progress of the human mind." To treat the founding documents as scripture would be to become a slave to the past. Some men look at constitutions with sanctimonious reverence and then deem them, like the Ark of the Covenant, too sacred to be touched, Jefferson conceded. But when they do, they ascribe to the men of a preceding age a wisdom more than human. Abolitionists adopted a different posture. They didn't worship the founders. They judged them. In the spring of 1829, William Lloyd Garrison, who'd entered the evangelical movement as an advocate of temperance and had only lately begun to concern himself with the problem of slavery, was asked to deliver a 4th of July address before a Massachusetts branch of the Colonization Society at the Park Street Church in Boston. He declared that the holiday was filled with hypocritical cant about the inalienable rights of man. This complicated position, a sense of the divinity of the Declaration of Independence mixed with fury at the founders themselves, came, above all, from black churches, like the church where Maria Stuart and her husband were married, the African Meeting House on Belknap Street in Boston's free black neighborhood on a slope of Beacon Hill known as Nigger Hill. Their friend David Walker, a tall, freeborn man from North Carolina, lived not far from the Meeting House and kept a slop shop on Brattle Street, selling gear to seamen. He liked to trade with James W. Stuart, who earned his living outfitting ships. Walker was born in Wilmington, North Carolina. His father was a slave, his mother a free black woman. Sometime between 1810 and 1820, he'd moved from Wilmington to Charleston, South Carolina, probably drawn to its free black community and to its church. At the very beginning of the revival, in 1816, the African Methodist Episcopal Church was founded in Philadelphia. Charleston opened an AME church in 1817. Walker joined. While men like Finney preached to the workers and bosses of Rochester, New York, black evangelicals preached to free blacks who were keenly aware of the very different effects of the age of the machine on the lives of slaves and slave families. Cotton production in the South doubled between 1815 and 1820, and again between 1820 and 1825. Cotton had become the most valuable commodity in the Atlantic world. The Atlantic slave trade had been closed in 1808, but a new and vast global market for cotton created a booming domestic market for slaves. By 1820, more than 1 million slaves had been sold down the river, from states like Virginia and South Carolina to the territories of Alabama, Louisiana, and Mississippi. Another million people were sold and shipped west between 1820 and 1860. Mothers were separated from their children, husbands from wives. When the price of cotton in Liverpool went up, so did the price of slaves in the American South. People, like cotton, were sold by grades, advertised as extra men, number one men, second rate or ordinary men, extra girls, number one girls, second rate or ordinary girls. Slavery wasn't an aberration in an industrial economy. Slavery was its engine. Factories had mechanical slaves. Plantations had human slaves. The power of machines was measured by horsepower, the power of slaves by hand power. A healthy man counted as two hands, a nursing woman as a half hand, a child as a quarter hand. Charles Ball, born in Maryland during the American Revolution, spent years toiling as a slave in South Carolina, and time on an auction block where buyers inspected his hands, moving each finger in the minute action required to pick cotton. The standard calculation for a cotton crop, 10 acres to the hand. David Walker, living in Charleston, bore witness to those sufferings, and he prayed. So did Denmark Vesey, a carpenter who worshipped with Walker at the same AME church. In 1822, Vesey staged a rebellion, leading a group of slaves and free blacks in a plan to seize the city. Instead, Vesey was caught and hanged. Slave owners blamed black sailors, who, they feared, spread word in the South of freedom in the North and of independence in Haiti. After Vesey's execution, South Carolina's legislature passed the Negro Seaman Acts, requiring black sailors to be held in prison while their ships were in port. Walker decided to leave South Carolina for Massachusetts, where he opened his shop for black sailors and helped found the Massachusetts General Colored Association, the first black political organization in the United States. Meanwhile, he helped runaways. His hands were always open to contribute to the wants of the fugitive, the preacher Henry Highland Garnett later wrote. And he studied. He spent all his leisure moments in the cultivation of his mind. He also began helping to circulate in Boston the first black newspaper, Freedom's Journal, published in New York, beginning in 1827. "We wish to plead our own cause," its editors proclaimed. "Too long have others spoken for us." In the fall of 1829, the year Jacob Bigelow and Thomas Carlyle were arguing about the consequences of technological change, David Walker published a short pamphlet that struck the country like a bolt of lightning, an appeal to the colored citizens of the world, but in particular and very expressly to those of the United States of America. Combining the exhortations of a revivalist preacher with the rabble-rousing of a Jacksonian political candidate, Walker preached that without the saving redemption of abolition, there would come a political apocalypse, the wages of the sin of slavery. "I call men to witness that the destruction of the Americans is at hand and will be speedily consummated unless they repent." Walker claimed the Declaration of Independence for black Americans. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." He insisted on the right to revolution. Addressing his white readers, he wrote, "Now, Americans, I ask you candidly, was your sufferings under Great Britain 1/100th part as cruel and tyrannical as you have rendered ours under you?" He described American expansion, the growth of the Union from 13 states to 24, as a form of violence. "The whites are dragging us around in chains and in handcuffs to their new states and territories to work their mines and farms to enrich them and their children." And he damned Manifest Destiny as a fraud, resting on the belief of millions of Americans that we, being a little darker than they, were made by our Creator to be an inheritance to them and their children forever. He called the scheme of Henry Clay's American Colonization Society the colonizing trick. "This country is as much ours as it is the whites, whether they will admit it now or not. They will see and believe it by and by." And he warned, "Are Mr. Clay and the rest of the Americans innocent of the blood and groans of our fathers and us, their children? Every individual may plead innocence if he pleases, but God will before long separate the innocent from the guilty." He asked black men to take up arms. "Look upon your mother, wife, and children," he urged, "and answer God Almighty and believe this, that it is no more harm for you to kill a man who is trying to kill you than it is for you to take a drink of water when thirsty." And remarking on the history of the West Indies, he warned the owners of men, "Read the history particularly of Haiti, and see how they were butchered by the whites, and do you take warning." In an age of quantification, Walker made his own set of calculations. God has been pleased to give us 2 eyes, 2 hands, 2 feet, and some sense in our heads as well as they. They have no more right to hold us in slavery than we have to hold them. And then, I do declare that 1 good black man can put to death 6 white men. The preaching of David Walker, even more than the preaching of Lyman Beecher or Charles Grandison Finney, set the nation on fire. It was prosecutorial, it was incendiary, it was also widely read. Walker had made elaborate plans to get his appeal into the hands of Southern slaves. With the help of his friends Maria and James Stewart, he stitched copies into the linings of the clothes he and Stewart sold to sailors bound for Charleston, New Orleans, Savannah, and Wilmington. The appeal went through 3 editions in 9 months. The last edition appeared in June of 1830. That August, Walker was found dead in the doorway of his Boston shop. There were rumors he'd been murdered. Rewards of upward of $10,000 had been offered for him in the South. More likely, he died of tuberculosis. James and Maria Stewart moved into his old rooms on Belknap Street. Walker had died, but he had spread his word. In 1830, a group of slaves plotting a rebellion were found with a copy of the appeal. With Walker, the anti-slavery argument for gradual emancipation with compensation for slave owners became untenable. Abolitionists began arguing for immediate emancipation, and Southern anti-slavery societies shut their doors. As late as 1827, the number of anti-slavery groups in the South had outnumbered those in the North by more than 4 to 1. Southern anti-slavery activists were usually supporters of colonization, not of emancipation. Walker's appeal ended the anti-slavery movement in the South and radicalized it in the North. Garrison published the first issue of The Liberator on January 1, 1831. It begins with words as uncompromising as Walker's. I am in earnest. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse. I will not retreat a single inch, and I will be heard. That summer in Virginia, a 30-year-old revivalist preacher named Nat Turner planned a slave rebellion for the 4th of July. Turner's rebellion was at once an act of emancipation and of evangelism. Both of his parents were slaves. His mother had been born in Africa. His father escaped to the North. The wife of Turner's owner had taught him to read when he was a child. He studied the Bible. He worked in the fields, and he also preached. In 1828, he had a religious vision. He believed God had called him to lead an uprising. White spirits and black spirits engaged in battle, he later said, and blood flowed in streams. He delayed until August when, after killing dozens of whites, he and his followers were caught. Turner was hanged. The rebellion rippled across the Union. The Virginia legislature debated the possibility of emancipating its slaves, fearing a Nat Turner might be in every family. Quakers submitted a petition to the state legislature calling for abolition. The petition was referred to a committee headed by Thomas Jefferson's 39-year-old grandson, Thomas Jefferson Randolph, who proposed a scheme of gradual emancipation. Instead, the legislature passed new laws banning the teaching of slaves to read and write and prohibiting, too, teaching slaves about the Bible. In a nation founded on a written declaration, made sacred by evangelicals during a religious revival, reading about equality became a crime. Alexis de Tocqueville, the sharp-eyed French political theorist and historian, landed in New York in May 1831 for a 9-month tour of the United States. Nat Turner waged his rebellion in Virginia that August. Maria Stewart's first essay appeared in The Liberator that October. If America ever undergoes great revolutions, they will be brought about by the presence of the black race on the soil of the United States, Tocqueville predicted. They will owe their origin not to the equality, but to the inequality of condition. Even as Tocqueville was writing, those revolutions were already being waged. 2. Maria Stewart was the first woman in the United States to deliver an address before a mixed audience, an audience of both women and men, which happened to have been, as well, an audience of both blacks and whites. She spoke, suitably, in a hall named after Benjamin Franklin. She said she'd heard a voice asking the question, "Who shall go forward and take of the reproach that is cast upon the people of color? Shall it be a woman?" And my heart made this reply, "If it is thy will, be it even so, Lord Jesus." Stewart delivered 5 public addresses about slavery between 1831 and 1833, the year Garrison founded the American Anti-Slavery Society, in language that echoed hers. At the Society's first convention, Garrison declared, "We plant ourselves upon the declaration of our independence and the truths of divine revelation as upon the everlasting rock." Shall it be a woman? One consequence of the rise of Jacksonian democracy and the Second Great Awakening was the participation of women in the reformation of American politics by way of American morals. When suffrage was stripped of all property qualifications, women's lack of political power became starkly obvious. For women who wished to exercise power, the only source of power seemingly left to them was their role as mothers, which, they suggested, rendered them morally superior to men, more loving, more caring, and more responsive to the cries of the weak. Purporting to act less as citizens than as mothers, cultivating the notion of republican motherhood, women formed temperance societies, charitable aid societies, peace societies, vegetarian societies, and abolition societies. The first female anti-slavery society was founded in Boston in 1833. By 1837, 139 female anti-slavery societies had been founded across the country, including more than 40 in Massachusetts and 30 in Ohio. By then, Maria Stuart had stopped delivering speeches, an act that many women, both black and white, considered too radical for the narrow ambit of Republican motherhood. After 1835, she never again spoke in public. As Catherine Beecher argued in 1837 in An Essay on Slavery and Abolitionism with reference to the duty of American females, "If the female advocate chooses to come upon a stage and expose her person, dress, and elocution to public criticism, it is right to express disgust." While women labored to reform society behind the scenes, men protested in the streets. The 18-teens marked the beginning of a decades-long struggle between labor and business. During the Panic of 1819, the first bust in the industrializing 19th century, factories had closed when the banks failed. In New York, a working man's wages fell from 75 cents to 12 cents a day. Those who suffered the most were men too poor to vote. It was in many ways the suffering of working men during the Panic of 1819 that had led so many men to fight for the right to vote, so that they could have a hand in the direction of affairs. Having secured the franchise, they attacked the banks and all manner of monopolies. In 1828, laborers in Philadelphia formed the Working Men's Party. One writer in 1830 argued that commercial banking was the foundation of artificial inequality of wealth, and therefore of artificial inequality of power. Working men demanded shorter hours, 10 instead of 11 or 12, and better conditions. They argued, too, against an unequal and very excessive accumulation of wealth and power into the hands of a few. Jacksonian democracy distributed political power to the many, but industrialization consolidated economic power in the hands of a few. In Boston, the top 1% of the population controlled 10% of the wealth in 1689, 16% in 1771, 33% in 1833, and 37% in 1848, while the lowest 80% of the population controlled 39% of the wealth in 1689, 29% in 1771, 14% in 1833, and a mere 4% in 1848. Much the same pattern obtained elsewhere. In New York, the top 1% of the population controlled 40% of the wealth in 1828, and 50% in 1845. The top 4% of the population controlled 63% of the wealth in 1828 and 80% in 1845. Native-born working men had to contend with the ease with which factory owners could replace them with immigrants who were arriving in unprecedented numbers, fleeing hunger and revolution in Europe, and seeking democracy and opportunity in the United States. Many parts of the country, including Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, recruited immigrants by advertising in European newspapers. Immigrants encouraged more immigrants in the letters they wrote home to family and friends, urging them to pack their bags. "This is a free country," a Swedish immigrant wrote home from Illinois in 1850, "and nobody needs to hold his hat in his hand for anyone else." A Norwegian wrote from Minnesota, "The principle of equality has been universally accepted and adopted." In 1831, 20,000 Europeans migrated to the United States. In 1854, that number had risen to more than 400,000. While 2.5 million Europeans had migrated to all of the Americas between 1500 and 1800, the same number, 2.5 million, arrived specifically in the United States between 1845 and 1854 alone. As a proportion of the U.S. population, European immigrants grew from 1.6% in the 1820s to 11.2% in 1860. Writing in 1837, one Michigan reformer called the nation's rate of immigration the boldest experiment upon the stability of government ever made in the annals of time.